Hi, Nick. How are you?
I'm good. I am so excited. I am buzzing right now because today we are kicking off a very special summer series that we're calling Shuffling Through History: Everything We Know, Don't Know, and Think We Know About the Tarot. And this is going to be a multi-episode deep dive that attempts to lay out as full a history of the tarot as we are able to offer to all of you wonderful listeners.
That is right. We are going to walk you, dear listener, through the entire journey of the cards from their origin all the way through to the present day.
And I want to give a shout out to our friend Elena Davenport from At Politics of Tarot on Instagram. Some of you may follow Elena. And a conversation that I had with them a few months ago, in which we were discussing different systems of tarot and the way that readers and teachers, just aren't always completely transparent, in my opinion, about where all of these correspondences and meanings that we sort of hear talked about and read about in books, where those come from. So that kind of is what inspired the idea for this series. So thank you, Elena.
Before we start, we want to honor that a lot of the history around the tarot is murky, but it is out there. We have worked hard to create this series as a resource for anyone who is learning the tarot or anyone who wants to have a deeper understanding of the history and the lineage that we're working in.
And we also want to name that we are not professional historians. We have been as diligent as possible in putting this resource together for you because this stuff really matters to us and we want to do it right. So, to start off, we're going to focus today on the origins of the cards and the evolution into Tarot de Marseille, which is one of the most popular systems of tarot. And just a little note that when we talk about a quote unquote system of tarot, we are referring to any combination of art, numbers, symbols, organizational structure, and or assigned correspondences and meanings. So do you want to kick us off, Angie?
Oh, yes, I have been waiting. So, I want to start with giving a brief history of the Tarot de Marseille. I want to point out that when you hear people talk about quote unquote traditional decks today, they're usually talking about the Smith Rider-Waite deck, which, although it's the most widely used deck in the world, it is far from the oldest deck in existence. Tarot expert Mary Kay Greer offers that to say the most traditional may not be correct because of the way that we understand the word traditional. But if when we what we mean when we say traditional is the most long-lasting, the most resilient, that might be a better way to describe it, and that could be definitely used to describe the Tarot de Marseille. I found articles that debated where the tarot originated and which time frame. Most said that they believe the tarot originated somewhere in the 15th century in Italy and then traveled to France and Switzerland from there. There are claims that the tarot originated in Egypt, but those are not true. A quote from Mary Kay Greer's blog says, quote, "Tarot did not originate in Egypt, but in northern Italy between 1420 and 1440. The period was characterized by a belief in the magical power of images. At the same time, there was a huge influx of scholars and manuscripts from Spain, where Jews were being persecuted, and from Constantinople, which was being invaded by the Muslim Turks. Cities in northern Italy, who welcomed these exiles, became centers of learning. Their libraries were full of books on magic, astrology, and formerly lost works of Greek philosophy. Much of this knowledge had been preserved from Alexandria in Egypt, home to an eclectic mix of Egyptian, Coptic, Greek, Roman, Hebrew, and East Indian learning. In 1422, a 5th century Greek manuscript called the Hieroglyphics of Hierapolo arrived in Florence. It falsely purported to reveal the hidden meanings of Egyptian hieroglyphs, and this had a great impact on the Renaissance thought. While a few of these images appear directly in the tarot, it added to the tradition that Egypt was key to the ancient wisdom, end quote. I found one article in which Philippe Camus, who is a descendant of the first manufacturers of the Tarot de Marseille, says that he found documentation of divinatory card decks going all the way back to the 1st century. I couldn't find anything further on that. Philippe Camois does have a book, which is now out of print and only published in French. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to get my hands on it to corroborate his claims. I also want to mention that among all the information I found, his claim was definitely the outlier. So I'm not prepared to take this as gospel, but it is there for anyone who wants to seek that out further.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've certainly never heard of that or encountered even his name before. So I'm glad you uncovered that. And I feel like that the point, you know, that you've made of that you weren't able to kind of corroborate these claims, I mean, that's not really unique necessarily in tarot history, as far as, you know, there's always questions in history or gaps in history. But I feel like the tarot in particular has a lot of murkiness in its history. And to be honest, I think people have not always tried that hard to clarify it, because, you know, it is a magical tool. And I think a lot of people enjoy the sort of mystery of it, you know? So, but I think that knowing history is also very freeing, you know? So,
I think there's a grand part of that too, that it's personal for these people, because it's, you know, a person who taught them. And so they attach their what they have received from their teacher as gospel. And so they're not prepared to kind of dismantle those teachings.
That's true. And also it's important to question who gets to keep the history, you know, whose views on history are being listened to or being widely, you know, printed or shared. Also cultures that maybe aren't even working with written word, but are only working in oral history. So lots of reasons why history can be murky or incorrect, you know. Card playing began in China and traveled down the Silk Road into the Islamic world. Many people believe tarot is a descendant of Mamluk style playing card decks, which were comprised of four suits with cards numbered 1 through 10, as well as three court cards, king, viceroy, and second viceroy. Merchants, diplomats, and sailors brought playing cards to Spanish and Italian ports from Islamic countries shortly before 1370. Card games spread quickly throughout Europe and for many decades were associated with Islamic culture. By 1370, card playing had become so popular in Europe that it had begun to alarm the establishment, who did not like people gaining the sense of autonomy, luck, and chance that was fostered in card playing. There is written evidence of cards being outlawed and sermons denouncing the practice.
Yes, in card trick-taking card games, that phrase is so hard for me. I keep tripping. One player leads with a card and the rest of the players have to lay down the same suit. To make things more interesting, one of the suits can be labeled as, quote, the trump suit, meaning its cards rank higher than any of the other suits. In some places, it was customary to give names to the trump suit cards. For example, in Carnaval, a game that was very popular in German-speaking regions in the 1420s, the trump cards were given names like the devil or the emperor or the pope. There is no evidence that Carnaval directly influenced tarot, but it shows that some tarot images may be rooted in folk traditions surrounding card playing.
According to Tim Husband, curator in the Department of Medieval Art at the Met Cloisters in New York City, tarot cards employed the standard Italian suits with values from 10 to 1 and with four face cards, king, queen, knight, and knave, for a total of 56 cards. Alongside them were a fool or motto, which was a wild card, and the 21 trump cards. Tarot was originally a game of chance, the rules of which are actually quite complex, and the codification of tarot as a tool for divination did not occur until the 18th and 19th centuries. And have you ever, Angie, have you ever Googled the rules of tarot or looked them up?
Yeah, it was actually during our last episode where we were kind of going into history that I was trying to understand the rules, and it was quite complex. I was like rereading things and it didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess people had more time back then to just have a very complicated card game.
What? Weird.
So three tarot decks have survived from the mid 15th century. One of the decks is thought to have been made for, and everyone please forgive me on the pronunciation I'm about to go into in these next few paragraphs, thought to have been made for Filippo Maria Visconti, the last Duke of Milan of that name, prior to his death in 1447. Known as the Visconti Tarot, the deck's 69 surviving cards are now preserved at Yale University. The other deck was more likely made for Francesco Sforza, a mercenary commander who served in both Milan and Venice and married the only child of Filippo Maria Visconti. Known as the Visconti Sforza Tarot, the deck was made sometime shortly after 1450. It is now divided. 26 of the surviving cards are at the Accademia Carrara, Bergamo, and 35 are at the Morgan Library and Museum, New York, which, by the way, when I was still living in New York, I just missed the exhibition of that deck at the Morgan. And apparently you can request to see it, which I never did, but I always wanted to do. So if anyone is listening in New York, maybe take a trip to the Morgan and request to see that deck.
Yeah, and email us about it when you finish.
Yes, please. Yes. And then a third deck known as the Brambilla deck, after a former owner, was almost certainly painted for Visconti before his death in 1447 and can be found at the Pinacoteca di Brera, Milan. All three decks are attributed to the Milan court painter Bonifacio Bembo. Bembo was born in Brescia, Italy in 1420 to an Italian family of painters. In all, there are thought to be 9 artists with the last name Bembo who were active in Cremona from 1425 until the early 1600s. In addition to the tarot, he painted portraits, frescoes, and biblical scenes. One final deck I want to mention is the Sola Busca Tarot, which was created around 1490 in Northern Italy and is named for the family who owned the deck until 2009 when they sold it to the Italian government. There are 2 theories about the deck's creator. Either he was an artist named Nicola, who had connections in Florence and Ancona, or he was an unknown Ferraresi artist living in Venice. We don't know if the artist created the deck himself or if it was a commission. What I want to point out about this deck is that it is the first deck to have illustrated all of the pip cards, something that I often have heard attributed to the Smith Rider-Waite deck. In fact, if you Google images of the cards in this deck, you will see an uncanny resemblance to the images later painted by Pamela Coleman Smith. This is because in 1908, the British Museum acquired black and white photographs of the Sola Busca deck, and Smith and A.E. Waite are thought to have visited the exhibition shortly before the publishing of their deck in 1909.
I've also heard that the Smith Rider-Waite deck was the first to have the pip cards all illustrated.
Yeah, that's what I mean, as I was coming into tarot, that's all I ever heard. And I only recently discovered this Sola Busca. I can't remember exactly how it came across. Oh, I think it was Bobby Abate from The Outsider Tarot who shared that with me. And I was so grateful because, you know, everyone definitely go Google this and you will be shocked how similar a lot of these images are. So the trump cards in the Sola Busca are illustrated with figures from the late Roman Republic, plus a few biblical characters. A few cards resemble the Tarot de Marseille. In trump 20, a man is struck by lightning while the top of a tower is being sheared off. Trump 7 shows a man wearing a laurel crown sitting in a fanciful purple chariot. And trump 12 is a bearded old man leaning on a staff and holding a lamp or a torch. The Roman numerals on the trumps are the earliest examples of tarot card numbering. The fool is numbered 0, showing that 19th century occultists weren't the first to think of this. And so when you do, if you do Google these images, you should not only kind of compare the same card to the same card, but also just look at the images on the whole, because some of the images, it appears that Pamela Coleman Smith sort of took, you know, an image from one card in the Sola Busca and used it for a different card in the Smith Rider-Waite deck. In the Visconti Sforza Tarot, the highest trump is the world, followed by the angels. The remaining trump cards in descending order are the sun, moon, star, temperance, death, traitor, old man, wheel of fortune, fortitude, chariot, justice, love, pope, emperor, popess, empress, and mountebank, followed by the fool. The Visconti Tarot, the older pack, diverges from the standard. It has as many as 6 court cards per suit, including a male and female of all ranks. In addition to the more usual trumps, it also includes three theological virtues: faith, hope, and charity. It is uncertain if this pack was uniquely structured or if it represents an earlier stage before the tarot were standardized.
So here we are during the days of the European Renaissance, and we've got the theories of Pythagoras and Plato and Plutarch and this melding of ideas from the East, India, Greece, and preserved knowledge from Alexandria in Egypt, and so forth, making an explosion out of Italy at the time. So we have these influence from ancient Sumeria, Judaism, and Babylonian symbols and seals that are making their imprints on the philosophy. We have the myths of Persephone and Demeter melding together with Osiris and Isis, and we can see the legacy of those in the Black Madonna and her metamorphosis over time. The Black Madonna, for those who don't know, sometimes referred to as the Black Virgin, are depictions of Mary, the mother of Jesus, depicted all over Europe, Africa, and the Middle East with dark skin. The reasons behind her being depicted with dark skin are still debated today, but it's said that, of course, while Mary herself would have likely had dark complexion, the Black Madonna was most likely a pre-Christian, or most likely had pre-Christian origins as a pagan goddess that later was re-envisioned as Mary by the Catholic Church. A great book, if you would like to read more on this, is on the Black Madonna, is Longing for Darkness, written by China Galland. And that goes more into the different iterations of the goddess figures. Now, some of the art from these seals is long-lasting in the tarot cards still today, such as creatures that surround the figure in the World card. The figure itself is thought to be Inanna, later known as Venus, and the Hanged Man imagery reaches back to the Babylonian myth of the weather god Adad. It's not until we reach the 17th and 18th century in France that we see it all reach the hands of the secret societies and into the hands of people like Court de Gibelin. And he's kind of the first guy who puts everything down into writing and attributes the meanings back to the Book of Thoth, which is an Egyptian book that he believed made its way into Europe thanks to the Romani people, which is where he believed the Romani people were from at the time.
So let's pause here to emphasize the importance of the Romani people in tarot as a lasting and widespread tradition. In 1530, England issued the Egyptian Act, which banned Romani from entering the country and required those living there to leave within 16 days. This soon led to the deportment of Romani all across Europe. In order to stay alive, the Romani were forced into a nomadic lifestyle and relied on the practices of divination as a means to stay alive. Mm-hmm. These practices they were forced into then became the basis on which they were persecuted. In the 1700s, white European male occultists began to fabricate mystical stories about the Romani people in the tarot, concocting the false claim that the cards were somehow connected to ancient Egyptian mystery schools and the teachings of the Jewish Kabbalah. Those stories continue to be embellished by white occultists throughout the next 200 years. And our next episode is going to be devoted entirely to this Romani influence on tarot, but we didn't want this first episode to go by without some mention of it, because it does all too often get left out completely in the narrative of tarot history.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that, Nick. I'm really looking forward to getting deeper into this. I wonder regularly what the tarot would have looked like if it weren't for their contributions, and that goes hand in hand with the persecution of their people and that they've endured that for centuries. So can we just take a moment to raise our hands and give some snaps to the Romani people?
Yes, absolutely.
The first modern tarot de Marseille that we know of was printed by Pierre Madeny of Dijon in 1709. In 1736, Chausson of Marseille printed what was to become the prototype for most later decks. By the mid-1700s, decks nearly identical to Chausson's were being produced in France and Belgium and in Switzerland. In 1760, Nicolas Convert of Marseille copied a Chausson deck directly onto his wood blocks, and this Convert deck became the standard deck in France, and it's still the gold standard for TDM to this day. So I want to go over a quick rundown of what the cards look like and a couple of the ways that you can use this deck, which I'll be brief because we will go more into depth into this when we hit our episode on Rider-Waite. We have the first 22 cards, the trump cards, which most will know as the major arcana. The Fool is the unnumbered first deck in the stack, or first card in the stack, usually named Limat for or Limat, it looks like in English. For the most part, the deck from its beginning hasn't changed all that much throughout history, which I think is pretty cool. But we have a few notable changes during this time. The Empress and the Emperor weren't very favored during the French Revolution, so they were replaced for a time with Grandmother and Grandfather. At one point, the Hierophant, or the Hierophant, depending on how you read that, and the High Priestess were the Pope and, very controversially, the Popess. There are a few other little differences in this time, the name and the placement of the trump cards. For example, the 13th card, usually known as the Death card, is unnumbered and unnamed in the Marseille deck. The 8th card in the Rider-Waite-Smith system is Strength, as opposed to the 8th card in Marseille, which is Justice, sometimes called La Justice or La Force.
That's so interesting about Grandmother and Grandfather. I love that.
No, isn't that interesting? I kind of like that better.
Yeah, it's cozy. By the late 1700s, European card players had switched to a new deck called the Turok deck, everywhere but Italy. Invented in Germany, Turok spread quickly through Central Europe and Scandinavia, and by the 20th century, replaced the TDM wherever the game of tarot was still played. Turok decks use French suits, hearts, clubs, spades, and diamonds. The trumps are double-headed and have decorative images that bear no relation to trump cards. In the 1770s and 80s, France was undergoing enormous political and social change inspired by news of the American War of Independence. Esoteric groups began popping up across towns in Europe. After the 1780s, decks for game playing and decks for divination went their separate ways. While game players dropped the TDM for more decorative Turok decks, members of esoteric lodges concocted theories that the TDM was actually a book of wisdom bequeathed from the Magi of ancient Egypt.
Ooh.
This marks
times here.
yes, exactly. This marks a crucial turning point for the tarot. As occultists began to develop elaborate systems of correspondences to go along with the tarot, they wanted to illustrate these new meanings and began transforming the Tarot de Marseille to fit their needs. This new way of looking at tarot was introduced to the public in 1781 when Antoine Cour de Gebelin published an essay on tarot in his multi-volume history of the ancient world, Le Monde Primitif. We'll go into more detail on the French occultist movement in a future episode. And I just want to say, I think that this is the biggest takeaway that I am taking from this episode in doing this research, is just that turning point. You know, that was something that I had not really, that hadn't solidified in my mind about the history of tarot, is when these French occultists took TDM and began transforming it to fit their needs, you know, based on the way that they thought about tarot, the meanings they thought the cards were meant to hold. They wanted to illustrate that in new ways. And I hadn't quite gotten that transitional piece, you know, so that was really good for me.
Yeah. I mean, I've told you this already, but for those who don't know, I was brought up under the idea that, yeah, it was a mystical system all the way from Egypt from, you know, thousands of years ago, and that it from its inception had these like magical meanings, and that's not actually true. So it was really good for me to kind of unpack that as well. In terms of how you can use the Marseille deck, from what I can tell, it can be used in one of three ways. Number one, you could ascribe the Rider-Waite meanings right over to the Marseille deck. Number two, you could use the short list of meanings created by the French occultists, or number three, you could use a combination of elements and numerology to create your own meaning. I personally felt like the latter made the most sense to me. I think of reading with elements and numbers kind of like each having a distinct flavor. And if you understand the flavors, you can read with a pretty clear understanding. And then of course you can decide whether you want to read reversals or not. A super helpful resource on reading with the Marseille deck is Dr. Yoav Ben-Dov's book, Tarot and the Open Reading, which we're going to go more into depth in a future episode.
So as I mentioned before, in our next episode, we're going to spend some time looking at the history of the Romani people, their indelible influence on tarot, and the blatant and harmful ways that they've been persecuted and overlooked through the centuries. And this brings us to the conclusion of today. So I hope that this gave everyone some new things to think about. I hope it brought the history of tarot into a broader context and kind of situated it in history. And, you know, this is a big endeavor that we're taking on in doing this series. We've been very excited about it, but it is a lot of work. So if you'd like to support this series and this podcast, please consider joining us over on patreon.com/insearchoftarot, where we share weekly essays, discounted workshop offerings, and host monthly tarot hangs, which we just had this past weekend, and it was incredible. And you can also click into your podcast player right now, wherever you're listening, whatever you're using, click right into that app and leave us a rating and a review. Tell us what you think of this episode and share it with friends.
And if you want to read more about the history we've shared today, be sure to check out our sources, marykgreer.com, ancient-origins.net, beyondenigma.com, tarot-heritage.com, en-academic.com, en-camois.com, and labyrinthos.co. We'll link to all of these in the show notes below as well, so check that out.
And you can share your thoughts on this historical conversation by emailing us at isotpod, that's ISOTPOD @gmail.com. And you can also follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot.
And you can follow me, Angie, at Bird Girl, that's BIRDGERHL_, on Instagram.
Thanks for listening, everybody.